From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on November 13th when a Rochester police officer offered an unusual piece of advice to a man who was trying to get into his girlfriend's house. The officer told him, "You can break in. You won't be arrested. You can even break a window." Now, the man had said he lived in the house, too, and now he wanted his stuff back, gift cards, things like that. He had dated the woman who did live there. And he stayed there regularly, even though his primary residence was listed in another town. But they had broken up. The previous night, things had turned volatile. They had argued. He left the house in his car, and there were competing descriptions of what happened next. He ran over her foot. She claims he tried to hurt her on purpose. He claims she ran into the car as he was leaving. Well, now he was back the next day, but she had changed the locks, and she told him, go away. She didn't want him there. She had been in other volatile relationships, she said, and she was clearly agitated that day. But the responding police officer told the ex-boyfriend he did have the right to get into that house if his things were there to retrieve the property, despite everything that had happened between them. So eventually, the man broke the window, trying to gain entry. The woman inside responded by holding a gun out the window. There is extensive video of the incident from the body-worn camera of Officer Corey McNeese, who had repeatedly told the ex-boyfriend he could break in. When police saw her holding a gun, they called for backup, and they screamed at her to show her hands, which she did quickly. The officers broke into the house themselves. They arrested her while she was lying on the ground. She was charged with unlawful weapons possession, which a judge dismissed because police unlawfully searched her home. In fact, the police advice to the ex-boyfriend was apparently wrong, too, and yet the woman is still charged with menacing a police officer because she responded to the break-in by holding a gun out her window. There are many layers to this story. We'll welcome our guests for the hour in just a moment, and we should say that the Rochester Police Department has withheld additional comment on this incident because it's still pending. You can understand that. But the Democrat and Chronicle reports, and we've just been able to confirm, kind of reading over some new policy, that as of March of this year, the Rochester Police Department issued a policy bulletin telling officers that when responding to a civil domestic incident, when one party is locked out of a home, they will not advise citizens that they have a right to break into the residence or that police members would stand by while he or she does that. End quote. Our guests for the hour in studio include Megan DeChateauview, Director of Development and Marketing for Willow Domestic Violence Center. Megan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Bill Gargan is the Chief of the Domestic Violence Bureau in the Monroe County District Attorney's Office. Bill, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Mark Henderson is Brighton Police Chief. Mark, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And on the line with us is Charon Sattler-LeBlanc, Local Chapter Leader for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense. Charon, welcome back to the program to you as well.
Good to be here.
I want to kind of set a few ground rules and make sure our listeners understand a few things here. Our guests, to the extent that they can, will have some things to say about this incident, but there's some limitations about that. And then we're going to have a broader conversation about domestic violence, the way police work with potential victims, work with these incidents, work to try to diffuse. So we can speak kind of broadly here. The Brighton Police Chief, Mark Henderson, I think is, number one, generous with his time for being here, particularly because this isn't his department, and you can understand why Chief Henderson can't speak specifically about this incident. So I'm not going to ask the chief, did this officer get it wrong, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to speak more broadly. Mark, for your department, you respond to how many domestic incidents, how often?
We were talking earlier, and I would say we respond to reports of domestic incidents on a daily basis. And I know, Megan, you're going to share some statistics that in the suburbs in Monroe County, there are over about 51,000 calls for service for domestic-related incidents. Ours number in the thousands, and so we have to be prepared on a daily, if not shift basis, to be prepared to respond to a call like this.
Okay. And Bill Gargan is Chief of the Domestic Violence Bureau in the Monroe County District Attorney's Office. Bill is not here to weigh in on prosecuting the woman involved in this case. And look, I've got questions. Our listeners may have questions. But that's just not number one, you really can't answer those, can you, Bill?
Fair to say? Anytime there's a pending case, there's not going to be any commentary on it. And that would be standard in literally any case.
Okay. I appreciate that. And I understand your position there. I do want to talk about a number of things. And how would you, first of all, describe what the Domestic Violence Bureau and your role as chief of it is in Monroe County?
What I'll do is I'll be capable of reviewing and assigning every single felony domestic violence case that comes in, with the exception of homicides, which are going to be distributed through the Homicide Bureau. So there are a team of prosecutors in our office that are assigned specifically domestic violence felonies. my goal is to engage with law enforcement regarding training and engage with law enforcement regarding evidence evaluation, and then help shape strategy regarding how we can most effectively prosecute domestic violence cases. They are unique in that there can be a successful prosecution of a domestic violence felony that results in state prison, and there could be a successful prosecution that results in perhaps ultimately only a violation conviction or a misdemeanor conviction, because each is tailored according to the defendant and the complainant as to how best we can provide peace and justice to those people.
Okay. And there's a lot to get into there. We'll get more into that in a moment. Let's kind of clear up any thoughts we have about the incident. And Megan DeChanteview from Willow Domestic Violence Center. Again, you may be somewhat limited in what you can say, but most of us now have seen this video. Listeners will post links to stories in which you can take a look at the body-worn camera. I mean, the Democrat and Chronicle and others have done really good reporting on this. Some early thoughts you have about this, Megan? Speak as broadly or specifically as you can, I guess.
I can't comment specifically on the case, but I can say that this instance shows how volatile domestic violence calls can be and how dangerous they can be and can escalate very quickly, and the importance of the first responders and law enforcement as being a focus on safety first and foremost, and looking at de-escalating the situation and not making it worse.
So, at the risk of pushing you too much, but let me just ask, were you surprised to see the video in which the officer is repeatedly saying you can break in?
That was a surprise, yes. And we do engage with law enforcement at Willow. We have lots of trainings, and we're currently conducting one this week with the Brighton Police Department, which is a phenomenal partnership to support the officers and make sure that they have the tools they need on the ground to work with survivors. And we do that with the RPD as well. And so the officers have the training. They have the significant tools at their disposal. And in this situation, I was surprised to hear this.
Okay. And so, again, I want to read specifically from the Rochester Police Department's bulletin on these matters, because you can understand, listeners, why they can't be here. This case hasn't wrapped yet, and there's a lot to it. But here is quoting from them directly, and they were kind enough to send that along to WXXI. Quote, when Rochester Police Department members respond to domestic-related incidents which involve one party having been locked out of his or her residence or having lost the key to the residence, members will not advise citizens that they have a right to break into the residence or that members will stand by while he or she does so. The basis for members not doing so is the fact that there is no definitive means for members to establish residency at the scene. Aside from the fact that members cannot definitively establish residency, allowing such behavior by one party of the domestic can possibly create a violent confrontation between the person or persons inside the residence and the individual attempting to gain entry, end quote. Does that make you feel better, Megan? Is that more appropriate?
This brings up a broader issue as well for me about the nature of abuse and domestic violence, and so much of it is about power and control and the ways that we see abusers manipulating our systems. So the abuser might call the police officers or call 911 with a claim against the victim. And so in that situation, we bring in primary aggressor training, which we do with the police force, to ensure that people can identify when they're on the scene what the situation is and what's actually happening. So we see this in the courts as well, that abusers will drag the survivor through court for years in custody cases and dragging things out forever as a way to make sure that they retain that control and power over someone's life.
Okay. And from everything that we can observe so far, and we'll see if there's more that plays out in court, the officer in this case, Corey McNeese, said, look, this has just been his understanding of the law for a long time. You have the RPD now stepping in to say, no, this is how we have to do it now, just trying to make sure that there aren't similar situations like this in the future. Because, you know, whether it's Officer McNeese or us watching this video, we don't know what happened the night before. You know, again, you have two sides of a story, but certainly something volatile happened. You can understand the fear that a woman would have when her ex shows up at her house demanding entry. And my understanding, too, Megan, is I don't think he was trying to gain entry to get life-saving medications, other things that he absolutely needed, documentation for job. It was things like gift cards, things like that. I mean, everybody can understand. When things calm down a little bit, maybe come back. You know, maybe come back at a different time, or I'll leave a bag out, you know. But it just didn't look like a time where things can diffuse. So speaking generally, when there's been volatility, sometimes it takes time for things to kind of diffuse a little, right?
Absolutely. And it can take time, and it can take something as simple as the officer speaking to the person inside alone. So to directly speak with the survivor and to find out what's happening from multiple perspectives. And if it continues to be something so volatile and dangerous, because these calls can be some of the most dangerous for law enforcement, then to take a breath and maybe come back, but not encourage any action that could be dangerous or escalate the situation.
Okay. Charon, when you saw this story, what was your first general reaction to it?
I was pretty overwhelmed by the footage, and there's just so many things to try to take apart with what happened. But I think what it highlights is the difficulty of responding to these calls and how things can escalate very quickly. And I think that highlights for particularly the work that we do with Moms Demand Action Against Gun Violence, excuse me, for Gun Sense in America, that the presence of a gun in a domestic situation can increase the risk of someone getting hurt or killed. For women in particular, the presence of a gun can increase her risk of being killed in a domestic violence incident by 5 times. What we've seen in the research too is that more often than not, when guns are present in the home, it is not used for self-defense. But most often the guns are used in escalating arguments. They're used to intimidate family members. Oftentimes that is women and children. And so, again, as you try to look at the video, you're looking at is this self-defense, or what we're seeing is an escalation.
All right. So to Charon's point there, and Charon is raising a point that when an officer responds and there's a gun there, immediately it complicates and it elevates the danger. Generally speaking, Chief Henderson, is that true?
I agree with that statement. It starts right at the onset of a 911 call. One of the questions that the telecommunicator will ask if there's weapons present in the home. And then a domestic incident report situation is a multiple officer response. It's a priority response. More than one officer will be dispatched to handle that. And if they have prior knowledge that there is a weapon in the home, they will take a cautionary approach. They'll immediately go in and ask where the weapon is in an attempt to secure it so it does not get introduced or injected into the situation that the officers are trying to investigate. First, if it's a chaotic situation, they have to gain calm to the situation, and then we have an obligation to conduct an investigation. We have to find out what happened, and if there's an allegation of criminal conduct, that we would have to investigate and document with a weapon being present, that would obviously raise a level of danger. So we would be asking to secure the weapon, and we'd be taking action to secure the weapon.
Is it as simple – am I distilling it too much when I ask you, Chief, that when your department gets a call for a domestic, you are hoping that the answer is no guns are present?
You would hope that there are no weapons present, you know, that there are no firearms or no knives, anything that could cause injury or harm to the individuals that are involved in the situation.
But what about women in particular, but people who say, look, I have a permit, and again, in this case, we're not talking about this November case in Rochester specifically now, but generally speaking, what about people who say, I have a permit, I am trained, I have a firearm, I am worried about self-defense, and I'm hearing a police chief say, I hope that you don't have a weapon if I get a call for domestic.
I'm hoping that a 911 call for domestic comes in. If we were to receive a call, that there is no weapon associated with that. I also understand that people can and do legally possess firearms and weapons. The problem comes in a situation where there's some type of volatility in a relationship that has escalated to some type of action that has caused one of the parties to call 911. We don't want that weapon, whether it's legally or illegally owned, to be part of what we're trying to at least gain control of. And then as we move into the second phase of the investigation, we don't want that weapon to be present.
Okay. And I think, Charon, back to your one of your initial points, which is just that when there is a feeling of need for self-defense, you're looking at statistics and data that tell you that more likely a firearm is not going to be used successfully in that case. It's going to be used in another fashion. Is that right?
The vast majority of times that a gun is used in the home is not for self-defense. And even in there's research that looks at those that report that it's self-defense, when you actually take it back, you're actually looking at using a firearm to intimidate someone that is in the home, someone that you know. So again, I think this story that we talk about, that using a firearm in the home, absolutely, if you are going to use it responsibly for self-defense, but more often what we see is these firearms are being used on people in the home or neighbors. It's someone that we know. So again, I'm not afraid of a stranger with a gun. I'm afraid of someone that I know with a gun.
I want to let our listeners know we'll be taking some of your comments and questions via email and phone. You can email the program at connections@wxxi.org. You can call toll-free 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester. 263-9994. Angela emails the program and says, in Austin, Texas, there have been some experiments with having trained social workers respond to domestic violence calls rather than just police officers. And she says that's had tremendous success in de-escalating situations there in Texas. What are the thoughts from the panel? Angela is talking about something that I have no research on, so I don't know offhand. Chief, I'll start with you. Do you know anything about that?
I don't, but on the surface, it sounds like something that I would be interested in looking to further.
Okay.
You know, we are not experts. As the program goes on, I'm going to talk about our relationship with Willow and our reliance upon Willow as a resource. But I'm very interested to do further research on the Houston model, and I'll get back to you on that.
Okay. And Bill Gargan, any thoughts on that?
I can tell you that one of the things that we do consistently with victims is to make them aware of the resources in the community, Willow Resolve and other resources that are there for them. They're not there for the criminal justice angle, because we'll sometimes engage with people who say, listen, I don't want to cooperate in this prosecution. I don't want this to happen. And we're hoping that they at least are aware that this intervention can be one that produces a positive engagement with her or him, with the community of domestic violence support that can exist. So anytime there's a way to expand information, and I think I gain credibility with my victims when I say, I want you to reach out to Willow, reach out to Resolve, because they're not going to help me. They're really going to just talk to you, to let you know that other people have been in your shoes, other people have had scenarios like this, and there are tools that can be given to you in this community, and that's a great thing. So, look, the possibility of social workers, I can't talk to the efficacy of that, but, of course, anytime you're getting information to somebody is a good thing.
Okay. Megan, thoughts on that?
I think it's a very interesting model. I do know that we have victim services advocates who reach out through the police departments as well, not accompanying officers on calls for domestic violence necessarily, but being there as a support. We are asking a lot of our law enforcement officers in these situations, too, to go in and maintain order and stability and try to promote safety as well as serve that role of a social worker. Here are the resources. And that's one of the reasons that Willow is so actively engaged with our law enforcement partners, to make sure that we're supporting them and that they have the information they need to come forward and have those referrals to all of our community resources. It's an interesting model. I'd like to see it more engagement with that, too, here.
You want to add to that, Chief?
I do. You know, I'll call it the Houston model, for lack of whatever it's called. Our response includes providing a card, a victim's rights card, that has direct contact information. It has direct contact information for Willow. It has the New York State Domestic Violence 800 number on it. So our officers, in addition to investigating, we do provide this resource card. What I'm hearing from the caller was that perhaps this is a more refined approach, law enforcement and social workers together. I'd like to see how they do that.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of threads to tie together if you want to pursue that model. For Angela, who wrote in, I mean, I don't know what funding would be necessary. I don't know what the cost would be, but certainly I think it will be interesting to see numbers and efficacy. Angela, if you've got data on that, because you said you think it's working well, send it to me and I'll check it out separately. I think that's a very interesting approach there. You just heard Chief Mark Henderson from the Brighton Police Department. Bill Gargan is here, who's chief of the Domestic Violence Bureau in the Monroe County District Attorney's Office. Megan DeChanteview is Director of Development and Marketing for Willow Domestic Violence Center. And Sharon Sattler LeBlanc is on the line with us, who's a local chapter leader for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense. Before we kind of keep it more broadly, on this specific incident, Sharon, I haven't asked you this, and I will. I don't know if you have an opinion on whether the woman involved in that November 13th incident in Rochester, should she be charged? If she had a gun without a license in this case, and she was fearful and she stuck it out the window, she's charged with menacing a police officer, you think she should be charged in this case?
I'm not comfortable to comment on that specifically, but I think what it does, like I said, it highlights the difficulty of domestic violence situations. And again, I think taking apart what was happening in the situation, you know, these were people who knew each other, and we are seeing that a firearm is being used. And there were a lot of things going on. So again, I don't feel like I'm really in the position to speak to that. But again, it just illustrates what we see time and again, that firearms are being used not in self-defense with strangers or people coming into the home that we don't know, but it's people that we know and that we should trust and have relationships with.
Yeah, and I would just say that part of the questions I think that need to be answered going forward that Bill Gargan cannot answer sitting here today. He's here speaking generally about his role with the DA's office, working as the chief of the Domestic Violence Bureau. But this is an ongoing case, and so it's Bill can't comment on this. But I wonder how you could be charged with menacing a police officer if you're not actually pointing a gun directly at an officer. If you're just sticking it out a window because you're scared, and someone has just broken into your home, the officer himself in the video says, she, when he calls for backup, she just stuck a gun out the window, not she aimed a gun at us. And I wonder if there's a distinction. I suspect we will find out as the menacing charge goes forward in court. She's going to have a bench trial, not a jury trial. So we will see on that. Let me grab a phone call. This is Janet in Rochester on the line. Go ahead, Janet.
Yes, good morning, or good afternoon, I guess. There's another fundamental root cause of the situation, and that is, I heard you mention that there are officers, plural, that responded at first. If one of the officers starts to go down a path that is improper, and in this case, for example, saying it's okay to break in when clearly it was not, the other officer there, even if they believe otherwise, is not likely to, in front of other citizens, say you're wrong and do something different. So it's very difficult in that situation to unwind. In cockpits, in hospitals, they have a process by which that can be done, where even a junior person can counteract the suggestions of someone else. Otherwise, we're going to have to assume that every single kind of situation that officers might encounter, they need to be trained on what is, quote, the right answer. So next week, next year, next month, it could be a very similar but slightly different situation as to what you can or cannot allow. So that's a piece I do believe that needs to be addressed.
Okay. Janet, thanks for the phone call. In a second, I'll kick it to Chief Henderson more broadly on just how officers work together and whether he does see maybe a reluctance on junior officers' part. I don't know. We'll ask him in a moment. But on the subject of, you know, in this particular case, yes, there were at least two officers who responded initially on November 13th in Rochester. And you did have the one officer advising the gentleman that he could break into the house to get his stuff. Tim, who is one of our listeners, wanted to know, why did the officer think that he could tell the resident to break in? You know, was it an old policy? My understanding is that it was simply based on sort of a faulty understanding of the law, that the guy had lived with this woman in a relationship, and so were common law living together, even though his established residence is in Livonia, and had some stuff still there after the breakup. And the officer might have thought, well, you've got legal access, that's your stuff, you common law lived there, but I'm not sure that the law supports that. And again, it's hard to kind of get into specifically with our guests here today because they can't comment on pending cases, but the law does not seem to support the officer's stance there. And the RPD has come out in the intervening months to say, don't do that. That's the wrong thing to do. In this case, we can't comment specifically, but Chief Henderson, Janet wants to know just about how officers interact. So you've got a couple officers on a call. Do you find hesitancy on the part of junior officers to kind of speak up if they see something wrong?
My experience has been that there's a team approach. And I can talk specifically to how I understand we operate in Brighton. Mm-hmm. We have a reliance not only with the interaction of the team, the partners, the officers, but their supervisor is also a key component to a decision-making process. From a Brighton perspective, Megan had mentioned we are going through training, as we do annual training, and we had an opportunity, and Willow was willing to come from a perspective of our domestic violence policy. Let's review our policy, let's review our procedures, and let's work with our partner and our resource, Willow. But getting back to the questions, my understanding is we do operate as a team.
Yeah, and to Janet's point directly, Chief, I assume you would tell your officers, I don't care how long you've been on the Fort Sutter, you see somebody doing something wrong, if it ever happens, don't be afraid to call it out, to step up.
Right. It's the co-pilot. I think I heard that reference in her call, the co-pilot that watches the pilot make a decision that could doom the plane. I'm not aware of that happening. I'm aware that if I was a junior officer, let me put myself in that perspective.
Yeah.
In that situation, if I was watching something unfold and I disagreed with what was handling, I certainly would express my opinion. If it was a safety factor, I certainly would express it even harder and intervene with a supervisor to assist us with this.
All right. We're going to get our only break of the hour, and when we come back, we're going to talk about these related issues. We'll take more of your emails and comments, questions, if you like. And we'll also talk about the issue of discretion. Now, maybe you're watching this particular case and saying, shouldn't there be discretion somewhere along the line? Shouldn't we be able to say, look, this is a woman who was scared. The judge has already said police unlawfully searched her home, so whether she had a license for this gun or not is immaterial, that she wasn't aiming at an officer, that this was an ex who's literally breaking into the home and putting giving her a criminal record for this, is that the right thing to do? How much discretion is there? How do we arrive at discretion for charges or interactions in these domestic situations? Speaking more generally, Bill Gargan will have, I think, plenty to say on the issue of discretion, and we'll get into that in a moment. And we'll explore, as Chief Henderson mentioned, the relationship between Willow, Brighton Police Department, and the advisement that they get that relationship. Teron Sattler-LeBlanc, a local chapter leader for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense, has more to say as we continue to have national discussions on gun policy and the impact of guns in volatile moments like these. So more of your questions, comments with our panel when we come back right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, some conservative newspapers say that college students and professors are going soft when teaching classic literature. They look at Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. They say too many of us have a sympathetic view toward the creature. We're going to talk about links to modern violent criminals, incarceration, reform, and more. Literature, Frankenstein, and us next hour. Well, welcome back to Connections. I'm sorry. See, look, the conversation barely stopped there. It doesn't ever stop. It's one of the shortest breaks you'll ever find in public or commercial radio anywhere, and we're right back here. We'll get back to your listener comments and questions in a moment, but during our brief break there, Megan DeChateauvieux from Willow Domestic Violence Center was raising the point on options that people may have here. And so you go back to November 13th, and here's a woman who is scared. Her ex is at her house. She's changed the locks. She's alleging that the night before, during a breakup, that he essentially tried to hit her with a car and ran over her foot. He says it was that she ran at the car, but there's a disagreement there. She's apparently said that she's had past volatile relationships, so she is dealing with a lot of fear. Tell me about options as you see them in a time like this, in a moment like this.
At Willow, one of our primary resources we provide for people is safety planning, and we talk about safety planning with all survivors that come to us or call us. And I think in that situation, our advocates would likely advise someone to call dispatch, to call 911, as if similar to when you're pulled over and you might not feel comfortable with the officer's requests. So in that moment, you could call 911 and say, this is happening, can you send out a second car? And the person, the citizen, has the option of being able to do that in that moment. And I think what she allegedly did shows how incredibly desperate and afraid that she was. And so when you're speaking with a survivor, when we're providing support to somebody and helping them to think about what might happen, what options might she have in that moment that would not lead her to a place of bringing a weapon in?
This is not the first thing that my mind would have gone to be honest with you, Megan. And Chief, generally speaking, is that right? If you're in a situation where you're nervous or you're not happy with the response you're hearing from police, can you call and try to get additional officers or a different opinion?
You certainly can call 911 and ask for a supervisor. And if there's a situation that's occurring and we're talking in general terms and there's a party that's present and they feel that it isn't, the advice that they're receiving is not proper advice, they certainly can call 911 and ask for a supervisor. There's a process in place that the 911 will then dispatch the on-duty supervisor, advised him and her of the circumstances about that, and then the supervisor then will be part of it. I can tell you from a Brighton perspective, on a domestic situation, it's quite possible that you'll see a supervisor on scene with the officers. So we'll have that level of authority at the scene.
Okay. And I want to turn back to Teron Sattler-LeBlanc here, because clearly, based on what you just heard from from Chief Henderson, from Megan de Chateauvieux, from Willow, that I'm sure if the woman involved with this could go back in time, that maybe she would do that. Maybe she would try as calmly as she could be to call 911 and say, look, I'm scared here. I've got a police officer literally telling my ex he can break a window and get into my house, and I'm here, and I don't want him here. Can they really do that? Can you get somebody else out here? That might have been, you know, sort of the better move than sticking a gun out the window. But I you know, it's easy for me to judge, I guess, is what I'm saying. But Charan, when we talk about gun policy, which you and Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense is working so hard on, a lot of the media attention gets caught up in mass shootings, school shootings, the Parklands of the world, understandably so. But the vast majority of gun death in this country is not that type of shooting. And I wonder, when we look domestically, when we look at guns in the home, are there policy options that you think are on the table that are more related to these kind of scenarios as opposed to the mass shootings that get a lot of the attention?
A lot of the work that we do as an organization is also around education. Legislation is certainly a part of the work that we do, okay. But a lot of the work I think we also need to keep working on is sort of the cultural understanding around guns. And the conversation that we have is fairly limited. You know, people... You know, one of the things that we talk about is self-defense, but also, you know, taking on that level of responsibility by bringing a firearm into your home. Also, you know, while it might be a right, it's a responsibility. And there's, you know, even our law enforcement goes through a lot of training every year. It's, you know, and to be able to think quickly in high-pressure situations like that, even in the situation you see law enforcement struggling to make the right decision. Now you have citizens who, you know, have a firearm in the home. They think it's going to do a number of things for them, but, you know, do we have sort of the background and the knowledge of, you know, de-escalation or, you know, the other skills and strategies? So, again, it is a tool, but, again, sometimes if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. So, you know, we have to work on this from legislation. We have to work on this from culture and education. But, you know, I find it frightening that this is one of the ways that we try to resolve problems in our homes and our communities.
And I'm getting emails from Gary and Brian, separate emails, both pointing out, and again, this is something we've got to fact check, that their understanding is that regarding social workers responding alongside police, the RPD used to have a civilian counseling team to respond to domestic calls called FACET, the Family Crisis Intervention Team, which does not exist anymore, and Gary thinks it's because of funding. Chief, do you know anything about that? Okay.
Yeah. I can't speak to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think that's RPD.
They do currently have the domestic abuse response team. There is a DART team that involves victim advocates and officers. So they do training internally and some response, but really in cases of homicide.
Okay. So again, with history and whether there was more staffing or more funding in the past for this, I don't know. But Gary and Brian pointed that out, and we will again check that separately. So don't necessarily take it to the bank, but we will try to get a little research for you on that. Bill Gargan, when it comes to discretion in cases like this, the law gives officers and gives, I mean, essentially the law has a lot of discretion in a lot of places, maybe less so in domestic cases?
Yeah, the law allows an officer to determine whether or not a case warrants an arrest in every facet except for one area. In one area, it's codified that a felony that is committed of a domestic violence nature, and again, it's described, or a violation of order protection, that officer must make an arrest. And I think if you look at the research that went into that alteration, you're looking at years and years of instances where the engagement of law enforcement with the victim is one in which the victim is asked, do you want to press charges? And all too often, perhaps unfortunately, that victim has already been told, if I go to jail, I will kill you. I will kill the kids. I will do something even worse. And so the victim is confronted with the decision and will sometimes say, no, I don't want them arrested, which would, you know, flummox, let's say, an officer. So it was codified that the discretion is taken away. And I really do believe that that is so well known throughout the state that you do have people that are aware that they cannot pressure the victim to not press charges so that an officer is going to make that arrest. And I find that that is a tool that helps to take the pressure off of the victim immediately, by allowing the officer who has done the investigation to determine that a felony has been committed so that an arrest does happen, and then we can kind of go from there.
Okay. Megan, how do you feel about that?
It's mixed. I think that in some cases that's incredibly useful. My concern with that is just, we had been talking earlier with Bill too, and he's fully aware of this, that some survivors might hesitate to come forward if they know that an arrest will happen because of the call. because of all those reasons that you just mentioned.
But okay, they would be hesitant to come forward because they don't want an arrest?
Yes, they might not call 911 if they knew that the incident would result in an arrest because of the threats the abuser has made. So if the abuser is saying to them that I will kill you and the kids, I will get out of jail, I will find you if I'm arrested, if you call the police, then those threats are promises that can be made real. I think in the situation when the law enforcement officer is responding, to have those tools at their disposal is critical in most cases. And I agree with everything that removes victim blaming and the pressure on the victim to pursue that, as well as the justice component of it. So we know that there's a situation that's happening that just is not right, and that codifying this creates that sense of justice and that path to justice more easily, but it does complicate things for the victim calling.
Okay, Bill, some thoughts on that?
I could tell you that when you look at the way that law enforcement has engaged with domestic violence, again, if we were here 50 years ago, we would have a starkly different conversation. And law enforcement, I think, consistently seeks to try to find different paths. I'll give you one example. The criminal mischief statute. For years, if an officer responded to an incident and people were married and marital property had been destroyed, an officer would be in a position of maybe not being capable of making an arrest because you can't destroy your own property and be criminally liable for it. So the statute was changed so that if somebody else has an ownership right to property, that means that the person, again, think of a married couple, who destroys that property can be arrested for it. That's a tool that didn't exist 15 years ago, but it does now, because you would have scenarios where an officer would respond because the husband, let's say, has trashed items in the house that were very important and valuable to that family, and the officer couldn't do anything. So you're constantly looking at different ways to do this.
The officer couldn't do anything about that in the past?
It was marital property. How can you arrest somebody for, you know, destroying your own property? So the idea was to change the statute to show that, well, if the wife owns part of that and you own it, by destroying it, you're destroying her part of it. So then now the arrest can happen. So you're looking at law enforcement seeking to engage with legislators to find out different paths to allow successful prosecution.
Yeah, I can think of offhand, just unfortunately, so many of us know friends, family members, know personal stories of domestic incidents, violence, et cetera, in which a threat can be made in one way, but also the destruction of property can be a way to really instill fear. I've seen it happen. A father to a child's stuff in between a marital couple, and it can be very frightening for families. And it just didn't even occur to me, Bill, that, you know, in the past you could sort of get away with that.
Yeah, and again, if you knew you could get away with it, that's a tool to use. Much in the same way, when you look at the strangulation statutes that were passed not that long ago, you had a scenario that was utterly terrifying, yet it would not provide law enforcement with physical injury that they needed to make a misdemeanor assault arrest. So they would be arrested for a violation, perhaps. And it was something that didn't match the terror that was inflicted upon that person. So now you have a felony of strangulation, you have criminal obstruction of breathing, you have these statutes. And if you look at the numbers, you know the law enforcement partners have engaged with those statutes, and you see a commitment to have those cases prosecuted. There is a development in our own community at the Heal Clinic at the University of Rochester with, you know, Kate Cerulli and many other leaders seeking to develop cameras that can aid in taking images subcutaneous so you can help record that which cannot be visible to the eye. And imagine seeing an image that has fingers across a throat that are subcutaneous to give an idea of exactly what transpired between the assailant and the victim.
Subcutaneous just means under the skin, right?
Yeah. So it's not visible. It's not visible. You know, an officer comes, we use photographs in every single prosecution that we can, that we're capable of getting them. But if you don't have the images, or if skin color of the victim is such that you're not going to have the images tell the story, you're going to be creative now and look towards that.
Chief, when you're called on domestics, does that happen? Has that happened throughout your career with some routine that there's destruction of property as a way to sort of punish or threaten?
We certainly have been called, you know, as a controlling mechanism.
Yeah.
I would give that as an opinion. But clearly, as you're walking into a situation and you see destruction, you can see that there was a level of violence that occurred. And then, as Bill explained the change in the law, we would be hamstrung. We would document our first call would be to the district attorney's office to say this is what we have. And prior to the change in the law, we were not able to make any prosecution. Now we have a tool. We'll work with Willow, with the survivor, and talk about what happened. And our policy is very, very clear. And our policy is the guide for our staff. And it says, and we were talking about discretion earlier, that the statute addresses it. Our policy addresses it. So our officers know, and I'll read it to you. When a police officer has probable cause to believe that an individual has committed a felony, the officer will not attempt to reconcile, mediate the parties, but will arrest the offender. That is the policy. That's what will happen.
Okay. And, Megan, when it comes to the destruction of property, can you give me a sense on, just how significant that can be as a tool to control? It's the chief used. I think that's a powerful word there. People, abusers can use that to try to control.
Absolutely. It's one of the tools in the toolkit of abuse. There are plenty of ways that abusers can exert control over the victim or survivor. And electronic leashing is another huge one that we see when you're stalking someone through their cell phone, monitoring their activity. That's becoming ever more popular with teens, as we know. Mm-hmm. I want to be clear, too, that I do support this idea of this statute. Of the officers being able to go and make the arrest, what I want to focus on there is to shore up the support for the survivors. So to have them feel comfortable with this happening, reaching out to the police and knowing that if their abuser is out of jail in 3 years, we can still find a way to maintain their safety. So that's the piece that the next step beyond that. In the moment you go, you see destruction of property, you see strangulation, you see anything happening, and the officer can then arrest the abuser in that moment. But then what happens, and how does our community come together to support the survivor long term?
What's the best way that that survivor can get support long term, particularly if someone has served a sentence?
Well, absolutely call Willow's hotline. You can call us and we will connect you with the resources. So the number is 585-222-SAFE. 222-7233.
Okay. And I'm also thinking, Charon Sattler LeBlanc, of the many victims who understand exactly the sentence of their abuser, and their response is, when they're out, I'm getting a gun. What would you counsel? I want to ask you two separate questions on the education piece that Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense does, Charon. Number one, for people, often women, but I'm going to say people in that scenario where their abuser has served a sentence and they have fear about retribution or other confrontation, and they think, I have to arm myself. What's the kind of education? I mean, what do you say to a person who in that scenario?
I cannot speak for the organization, but I think, when you have a survivor who's coming out, and I think, Megan is probably in a much better position to speak to this. We want to educate, and so they know what their options are. And also recognizing, when you bring something in like a firearm, the risk that may bring into the home. Again, if there's children in the home, you need to be thoughtful of that. You need to think about safe storage. You need to think about, at other times where other people might want to access that. We think about our teenagers who are going through a difficult time and the risk for suicide. So, again, it's just recognizing that if that is something you're bringing into your home, that you're getting the right training and to handle it responsibly. But I think there's just so many other, personally, for me, and just from the research, too, is, oftentimes, even if a woman brings a firearm into her home thinking it's going to keep her safe, the research bears out that more often she's putting herself at risk.
In this case, back on November 13th, the night before, the woman is claiming that the altercation with her ex led to her being scared enough to change the locks, and I don't know when she acquired the weapon that she held out the window when her ex broke into her house. I don't know if it was literally that day or not. What would you have cautioned her if she would have said, look, he broke my foot with his car. We disagree over how that happened, but she's scared, she's going to change the locks, and she's going to get a gun. Is it the same kind of advice that it might make you feel safer, but it's not going to make you safer?
I think there's a lot of other options to utilize to find safety. Again, contacting resources like Willow. Obviously, even starting with filing a report with the police about this altercation to let them know what had happened and have that documented. Certainly, things just continue to escalate in that situation, and I don't think breaking the window was a good idea, and I'm not sure, I'm sure there's a lot of things we could think about that could have been handled differently in that scenario, but what we know is that when there's a firearm in the home, even when a woman believes that she's getting that to protect herself, more often than not, she will find that that firearm is used against her.
Let me get to Tim's email. He says, can we stop using the term domestic dispute when it comes to some of these violent or possibly violent cases? A domestic dispute is an argument between my wife and myself. I think using the term dispute downplays the seriousness of these cases, and a much stronger term should be used. I'm tired of hearing it. I think using it is a great injustice to the woman who's being abused. You agree with that, Megan? I mean, is dispute too late? In cases like this, I take Tim's point because I think precision of language in all walks of life is a good thing, particularly when you're talking about violence, victimization, etc. So I get Tim's point there. What I don't know is what happened the night before with this couple in November in Rochester. There's two different characterizations. I'm not at all using this microphone to say I don't believe her, but I'm trying to be as precise as I can, and Tim hears that as the word dispute, and not just this case, but a lot of cases, is downplaying too much. What do you think?
Dispute sounds like an argument. It sounds like there are two sides to this, and domestic violence is a relationship abuse. It's intimate partner violence. Another precision language issue is the term domestic. So when we talk about domestic violence, we're not talking about a home necessarily situation. They don't have to live together. It can be partners that live together once and don't anymore. And this situation in particular is that case. And that can transcend any of these boundaries. So we still use the term domestic violence to refer to this because in the mainstream culture, that's what we've come to understand. And I believe that domestic dispute is a similar term. And I defer to Chief on this, where we've just always used it and it's what's comfortable.
That fair, Chief?
That's fair. And I'll share with you the New York State mandate, the report that we use for reporting incidents of domestic violence. It's the New York State Domestic Incident Report, a DIR. In the police world, you try to use as few words as possible to describe a situation. Mm-hmm. I've heard officers refer to a situation they ran as a domestic as opposed to a domestic violence report or a domestic incident report. So in an effort to shorten things up, the term domestic, it doesn't downplay the seriousness of the incident. It is a domestic violent situation. And the definition, I'm entering my 34th year in law enforcement, the definition of a domestic incident has changed markedly over the years.
Interesting. And Tim, I'm just reading here just because Tim's got me thinking about language choice. Altercation is not a word that I would have immediately known the exact definition, but when I see it, I think it's better than dispute when it's not physical violence. Altercation is defined as a noisy, heated, angry dispute. A noisy, heated, angry dispute. Altercation may be a better word than just dispute because, dispute just sounds like, you know, you're arguing over why did you take the last piece of bread.
Bill? Altercation sounds like a bar fight to me.
It does?
It does.
Altercation doesn't necessarily mean violence. It means dispute of some kind that's noisy, heated, and angry. But, okay, I mean, Tim's got us thinking about this. Bill, go ahead.
I had a law professor at Buffalo. Her name was Isabel Marcus, and she found that phrasing to be so important. The title of her class was Terrorism in the Home. Mm-hmm. And she did that, again, many, many years ago, and it was to drive the point home regarding what exactly was there. And then in talking about phrasing, there's another phrase I wanted to share with you that when I hear it, given what I do, I cringe. But there's a certain men's garment, a shirt, that is often known as a wife beater. And if you now will think of that phrase in a manner which would repulse you, but that is a phrase that was used very commonsensically. People would use this. And it's, again, the language.
Yeah, I think that's... I'm going to think about that the next time I hear that term because you hear it often, especially this time of year. Megan, before we go here, on this specific incident, November 13th, just some final thoughts from you about what you'd at least like to see come out of it. And I'm not even necessarily talking about the prosecution of this woman for menacing a police officer. I'm curious to know, you know, if you think that we can learn enough to try to find a way to turn this into a societal good here.
This has prompted a lot of conversations, a lot of really good debate and dialogue with our partners in law enforcement and internally our advocates at Willow. And I think that we are speaking a lot today about crisis response and that the answer really lies in prevention activities. So the more that we can do as a community to respond to the calls when it is an emergency situation, that's very important. But the way that we're going to end domestic violence and to change the culture here is to focus on prevention.
Okay. And Charon Sattler-LeBlanc, some final thoughts from you and where people can learn more about Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense?
certainly do a quick search for us on your browser of choice, Moms Demand Action or Every Town for Gun Safety. We have chapters in all 50 states, and it's we do a lot of work on education and working with neighbors to get involved in the process, talk to their legislators, and also to, you know, talk in their families. I think so much of the conversation around gun violence, whether it's suicide or domestic violence, is hidden with a lot of shame and secrecy. And it's really important that we start having these conversations so that we can make better informed decisions and keep more of our communities safe.
And just about 30 seconds, Chief. I know Willow has done a lot for Brighton Police Department. That relationship continues to be important to you, huh?
It is a very important relationship. And Willow, it's not just the Brighton Police Department. It's all in law enforcement. It's such a valuable resource that every year a number of my colleagues will join me in high heels as a fundraising effort for Willow. It is important.
Thank you.
It is an important community resource.
Our thanks to all of our guests today. You just heard Mark Henderson, Chief of Brighton Police. Thank you, Chief. Thanks for being
here.
Appreciate your time. Megan DeChateauview from Willow. Again, online where? Information?
WillowCenterNY.org and our hotline at 222-SAFE.
Okay. Thanks to Chiron Sattler-LeBlanc. Thank you, Chiron, for taking the time for the program today.
My pleasure.
And our thanks to Bill Gargan, Chief of the Domestic Violence Bureau in the Monroe County District Attorney's Office. Bill, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
Short break. More connections coming up.